finds tension in the Lebanese capital. A protest against U.S. interference in a probe into last year's catastrophic Beirut port blast turns violent. Bulldozing Palestinian property, Israeli forces destroy dozens of structures north of the occupied city of Al-Quds. Iran warns Israel against any military adventurism, saying Tel Aviv's provocative threats against Tehran have increased at an alarming rate. Hello and welcome, everybody. Heavy gunfire has been heard in the Lebanese capital, Beirut, where protests are underway against the judge investigating last year's catastrophic port explosion. At least one person was reportedly killed and several wounded in the unrest. Army troops have cleared the area where the protest is being held. Demonstrators, including supporters of the Lebanese resistance movement Hezbollah, say Judge Tariq Bitar is swayed by the United States in the probe into the port blast. The protesters are outraged at what they see as Washington's interference in the investigation. Hezbollah has already voiced its objection to the U.S. intervention, saying it violates Lebanon's sovereignty. Hezbollah has called for the removal of the judge. Lebanon's Central Security Council is to hold an extraordinary meeting this afternoon to discuss the situation. Well, we're going to cross over now to our correspondent, Mariam Saleh, who's in the Lebanese capital, Beirut. She was on hand with the demonstrations as we spoke to her earlier. Mariam, welcome back. All chaos has broken loose since we last spoke. What's going on there?
Well, we are here still at the Justice Palace. We walked with the protesters for a few meters, and then we heard the gunfire, and then therefore the protest itself decided to end the protest and disperse, despite the fact that we know reports that only meters away there were protesters that were coming to the area where the protest was going to gather here at the Justice Palace. However, those people were shot at by sniper fire, reportedly by snipers on top of buildings that are in the other area, which is considered an area where we have an authority for or a stronghold for the Lebanese forces political group. Here you can still hear that gunfire and even heavy or medium range gunfire. We are waiting to learn a little bit more about the importance of the exactly what is happening and to know the source of the fire. We know that there is.
All right. Unfortunately, we are experiencing some technical difficulties there. Hopefully, we'll hear from our correspondent, Mariam Saleh, later on as she brings us up to speed on the recent developments that are taking place in the Lebanese capital, Beirut. Well, Israel keeps destroying and seizing more Palestinian property in the occupied West Bank. 30 commercial facilities, including a gas station, have now been demolished. The demolitions took place near the Ghalandia checkpoint north of Al-Quds. Israel is planning to build a tunnel linking a highway to one of its settlements in the area. It also wants to build a new settlement there. All Israeli settlements are illegal under international law. Israel regularly demolishes Palestinian homes, claiming they lack building permits. A UN report says in August alone, nearly 100 Palestinians were displaced when their homes were destroyed in Al-Quds. Our correspondent in Ramallah, Mona Kandil, explains why Israel is pushing to force Palestinians out of areas near Al-Quds.
It's a Palestinian area, but it's very close to the Israeli military checkpoint, and that's why the Israelis refused to give Palestinians any permits in order to force them leave that area. On the one hand, the Israelis are trying to force the people leave their homes and their neighborhoods in the areas around Al-Quds, even if it's in the occupied West Bank, and sometimes because it's very close to the separation wall and very close to the Israeli military checkpoint, as the area we are speaking about. Well, these are small facilities, small shops where the Palestinians sell vegetables and the fruits there, and there's a very small gas station there owned by the one of the people living in the Columbia military checkpoint, because they know it's an area that the Palestinians unfortunately need to get Israeli permits. However, it's a Palestinian area, but because it's very close to the checkpoint, they need to get Israeli issued permits for constructing.
Well, as promised, we're going to go back to the Lebanese capital, Beirut, where heavy gunfire has been heard there. As protests were underway against the judge investigating last year's catastrophic port explosion. Mariam Saleh, our correspondent there, is back with us. Mariam, please pick up where you left off.
Well, we were saying that we do have reports that there were snipers on top of buildings shooting at the protesters. The protesters were unarmed. They were on their way towards this protest that was held here facing the Justice Palace. Here we're talking only 100 meters or so away. It's not far. You can still hear the gunfire as we speak right now. We know that so far only one person has been martyred and several people injured. Now we hear medium gunfire or perhaps bigger RBGs and that are being fired right now. Like we said, the sources were not very clear, although we did have warnings from the Lebanese forces militia that there would be some sort of action against this protest. It seems that they have decided to take a violent action. Of course, Hezbollah has stressed that they would not accept any sort of incitement of violence on the streets. This was meant to be a protest which is peaceful, and here we're talking about the fact that they are protesting the actions and the policies of the current prosecutor judge on the Beirut port explosion, saying and stressing that this probe is being conducted selectively. It is being politicized. There are arbitrary charges against very specific former ministers and former prime minister, specifically Hassan Diab. We heard from Hezbollah Secretary General, Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, in his last speech, really raising the voice against Judge Bitar, who has been in office, has been responsible for this file for the last 8 months. And throughout those 8 months, he has not changed his policies and the way he was dealing with it, specifically bringing in as accused and not as witnesses, specifically the former Minister of Finance, the former Minister of Transportation, and the former Minister of Works and Industry. And though, in addition to the former Prime Minister Hassan Diab, those people selectively were chosen from all the former officials or current officials. And Sayyid Nasrallah stressed that, why didn't you call in or ask for the testimony of President Michel Aoun, the former President Michel Sleiman? We had also a former Prime Minister who was at the time of those ministers, Prime Minister Saad Hariri, for example. He was not also, and not even for a testimony as a witness or summoned in any way. And these are just some examples. Other examples that we're talking about are judges that had signed the approval to bring in the ammonium nitrate into Port Beirut. All those judges were not either taken. We didn't even get he didn't get their testimonies. He didn't take them as witnesses or charged in any sort of way, although they bear the highest responsibility. So there are several issues that Hezbollah and its allies are calling for. The allies specifically, we're talking about Hezbollah, the Yamal movement, the Maradab movement, that are being targeted by these charges. First of all, is that they want from this judge to at least file or conduct a technical report. There should be a technical report, the details with which show exactly what had happened. Was it in any way a terrorist act? We don't have answers to that. Was it also the result of mismanagement? The mismanagement, was it done only at the time of the Hassan Diab government, despite the fact that that ammonium nitrate that was that exploded in the port was there since the year 2013? And since that time, we've had at least three prime ministers, over a dozen of ministers involved in this case, and those who were knowledgeable, who knew about the fact that there was ammonium nitrate that was very dangerous and risky material in the port. All of those ministers should have been taken in at least as witnesses to take their testimonies and so on. That did not happen. There was only specific targeting to only one group, which is Hezbollah and its allies. And so therefore, this seemed to be, for Hezbollah, very clear, selectively, and arbitrary method, and that would lead them to legally be able to take to take action. We did not just only see a popular protest here. We also saw a legal protest with a group of attorneys and judges who came in as well to say that they will also protest legally in the courts against Judge Bitar, saying that what he is doing is either not going by the law, because we have a certain decree when it comes to Lebanese law that presidents and members of parliament, speakers, prime ministers, and ministers can only be judged in a specific court. What he's doing is not specialized, and he is taking them in a way that is considered above the law, that is not legal. We had just yesterday one decision from one judge after a plea by two of the ministers that said that he needs to suspend the work of Tariq Bitar only temporarily until, of course, the investigation into this issue are uncovered. So this was the main aim for Hezbollah and the Amal movement, just to hold a protest here, a peaceful protest. What we're seeing right now is that there are certain groups, and we do have reports that group specifically, the Lebanese Forces Militia, is being armed and trained by the United States, whether they are being trained here in Lebanon, given arms here in Lebanon, or taken to the United States itself, and being armed militarily in order to be able to launch a sort of civil war inside Lebanon, a new civil war. Hezbollah has stressed on and on, whether through the speeches of Hezbollah Secretary General and the other other speeches from other officials in Hezbollah, that they will not succumb to any civil war. They would not accept that there would be a civil war. And of course, it takes two sides for there to be a civil war. So hopefully these statements from Hezbollah could lead to the fact that this can be contained and there would not be internal violence and incitement. However, Hezbollah does have a war coming up, and that is considered not perhaps militarily, but we heard it from the head of the Executive Council in Hezbollah, Sayyid Hashim Safiuddin, very recently. He said that there will be, that Hezbollah will try to take on the U.S. and all the Lebanese institutions. Hezbollah will not accept that the U.S. interferes in any of its internal governmental institutions, and that is what we're seeing right now. The protest here was the first step, but it seems that the U.S. is being using some sides as an objection, but they're doing it violently, as we see today from these this violence. We'll see, of course, we'll let you know what has happened exactly, how this uncovers, and what are the results of this violence that we're seeing today from the Lebanese forces.
Thanks a lot, Mariam Saleh, speaking to us from the Lebanese capital, Beirut. Moving on to the occupied West Bank, which is not the only aggression targeting the Palestinian population. The Israeli forces have also fatally shot a young man in the early morning hours. Palestinian media say the incident took place at Qalandia checkpoint in southern Ramallah on Thursday. The victim's identity is not known yet. Regime forces claim they shot the Palestinian driver because he ran over an Israeli soldier. In recent weeks, Israeli forces have killed several Palestinians during raids in a number of West Bank towns. The Iranian ambassador to the United Nations has warned against any Israeli miscalculation or adventurism toward his country's nuclear program. In a letter to the president of the UN Security Council, Majid Takht Ravanchi said Israel's provocative threats against Iran have increased in an alarming rate. He cited Israeli official statements as saying that the regime is accelerating its strike plans against Iran. The envoy said such statements are a clear violation of international law, particularly the UN Charter. Takht Ravanchi noted that Israel was undoubtedly behind acts of sabotage against Iran's nuclear program in the past. He urged the world body to hold Israel accountable for its destabilizing acts. Political commentator Kevin Barrett says it's unlikely that the United Nations take any stance against Israeli threats, as the world body is controlled by big powers beholden to Tel Aviv.
Israelis are once again threatening to commit the supreme war crime. And the United Nations needs to do something about it, because if Israel and when Israel attacks Iran, Iran has every right to retaliate in kind proportionately under international law. And that could set off a tit-for-tat of escalation that could lead to a crisis. And that's what the United Nations is supposed to be there for, is to prevent such things from happening. But because the UN is so dominated by these great powers that are essentially controlled by Israel, it's not much good at stopping Israeli aggression.
Well, Japan is getting ready to hold its snap elections at the end of this month. It's been only days since Fumio Kishida became Japan's new prime minister. He's now dissolved the lower house of parliament in preparation for the vote. The vote will pit Kishida's party leading in early polls against main opposition the Constitutional Democratic Party. For voters, the coronavirus pandemic, economy, and employment are the main concerns. Kishida has promised to improve the government's COVID-19 response, promote economic growth, and increase Japan's defense potential. The former administration faced a lot of criticism over its management of the coronavirus crisis and the holding of the Summer Olympics in Tokyo despite the pandemic. The World Health Organization says it has formed an advisory group to determine the origins of COVID-19 in China. The WHO says 26 members of its scientific advisory group have been named to join the investigation in the Chinese city of Wuhan. The UN body says the panel may be the last chance to establish the origins of the virus. It has called on China to provide data from early cases. The first human cases of COVID-19 were reported in Wuhan in December 2019. A separate team was in Wuhan earlier this year, but failed to find out the virus origin. China dismisses theories that the virus leaked from one of its laboratories. And Taiwan is giving assurances that it will not be decide to start a war with China, but it will not hesitate to defend itself if there is an attack. The island's defense minister, Chu Kuo-chang, says Taiwan wants to maintain the status quo with China, but it's prepared to counter, quote, the enemy full on. Taipei's growing military ties with Washington have angered Beijing. China says its recent military maneuvers near Taiwan were meant to ward off foreign threats. Taiwan considers itself a sovereign state, but Beijing views the island as a breakaway province and maintains sovereignty over it. And that brings us to an end here on this edition of World News. Bye.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Tourism. In the name of God, Salam, and welcome to the 12th episode of our series, Health Tourism. In this episode, we are going to take you to the island of Kish in southern Iran and introduce you to the super specialty acute care hospital known as Kish Hospital. Please stay tuned. Kish is one of the islands in the Persian Gulf in southern Iran that extends from the north to mainland Iran, from the east to the Strait of Hormuz, from the south to the United Arab Emirates, and from the west to Bahrain and Saudi Arabia. The area of Kish Island is 91 square kilometers with 43 kilometers of beautiful coastline. Kish Island is covered with palm, mesquites, jojoba, eucalyptus trees, and like any other island, it has a humid climate. Most of the rainfall in Kish Island occurs in winter and is usually in the form of showers. There are four regions in the world that have a high percentage of pure oxygen, and Kish is one of them. According to history books, Kish Island has been an integral part of Iran since the Achaemenid period, that is over 2,500 years ago. The island has been Iranian territory ever since the Achaemenid, Parthian, and Sasanid eras, and was the focus of attention of many governments throughout Iran's history. During the last century, special attention has been paid to this island, and since 1982, it has been known as the first free economic zone of Iran. The island's economy is mainly based on tourism and trade. Kish Island, due to its unique beauty, is one of the main tourist destinations in Iran. The island attracts not only domestic travelers, but also a large number of foreign tourists. It has an international airport, the construction of which kicked off in 1968 by the Urban Planning Department in Kish. The engineers and architects who commissioned the airport borrowed some ideas from the construction of airports on the Hawaiian Islands and the southern shores of the Mediterranean to build this facility of Kish. The airport has four different terminals that serve both domestic and international flights at the same time. On average, more than 1.7 million tourists visit the island annually and enjoy the city's leisure facilities. Among the tourist and historical attractions of this city, we can mention the traditional cistern, the Greek ship, the underground city of Karis, the historic city of Harire, and so on. Water sports are also very popular in Kish, and the island has a history of hosting a volleyball world tournament every year in its sporting calendar. Kish Island has a significant position within Iran's tourism industry. This has led to more attention being paid to the existing potentials in the field of medical and healthcare tourism on the island. At present, Kish Island is equipped with a super specialty acute care hospital called Kish Hospital, which offers a wide range of medical services to both residents and tourists on the island. Kish Hospital has been operating since 1993 with 32 beds, and in order to develop the hospital in 2013, the third phase of the hospital was opened and the capacity of the hospital was upgraded to 64 beds. The hospital has succeeded in attaining many honors in accreditation evaluations of Health Ministry in 2015, including receiving first-class hospital title, a first ranking in medical diagnostic labs, as well as the first in the ranking of intensive care, that is CCU, ICU, from Iran's Ministry of Health. Kish Hospital is also a general hospital, which offers all specialized and subspecialized services, including orthopedics, knee and knee replacement surgeries, neurosurgery, ENT, as well as all cosmetic and gynecological surgeries. In addition to the hospital's medical wards, laser therapy, endoscopy and colonoscopy, physiotherapy, ethnocardiology, cardiac rehabilitation, stone crusher, bone density measurement, dialysis, pharmacy, and a 24-hour lab services are provided in this state-of-the-art medical complex. The hospital is also equipped with an isolation room, which is approved by the World Health Organization, WHO, and is used for hospitalized patients with respiratory infections. Kish Hospital also provides medical services to foreign patients traveling to Kish Island. Appropriate medical infrastructure in Kish Island has provided the possibility of offering appropriate specialized medical services to foreign patients. Therefore, Kish Hospital has launched its International Health Department for several years in order to develop health tourism and has so far admitted patients from many different countries such as the United States, Bahrain, Kuwait, Uzbekistan, and Oman, etc. The satisfactory quality of medical services in this hospital, affordable cost, the presence of specialized doctors, and the lack of the need to obtain a visa have made this hospital quite popular among foreign patients. The VIP ward of the hospital has 3 suites. And provides the necessary amenities for the patient's family to stay with the patient. This section is staffed by experienced and fluent nurses in several foreign languages, including English, Arabic, Turkish, etc. The VIP area is designed in a way that the patient feels at home and has all the amenities. In order to develop the health tourism of the island, Kish Hospital has established an office in Muscat, Oman, called Kish Hospital, and in addition, it intends to open an office in several cities of Afghanistan. By this way, patients can refer to the hospital offices in their country and obtain the necessary information about the hospital and doctors before traveling to Iran. In the presence of international patients, services are provided completely VIP, whether in their checkups and patients and in their admission and discharge or in hospitalization, completely VIP services are performed without wasting any time. 2 translators fluent in Arabic and English are present at the hospital during the admission process, hospitalization, and after the patient is discharged, follow-up of patients is done through phone calls, WhatsApp, and email, and in case of any problems, the hospital will respond and follow up on the issue. Kish Hospital has held extensive negotiations with airlines and facilitator companies in order to promote health tourism, following which contracts have been signed and offices have been set up in Oman. So far, Kish Hospital has been able to be one of the top 5 medical centers in this field in the Summit and International Tourism Exhibition of Islamic Countries. In hospital grading and international standards, many measures have been taken in order to obtain international standards and approvals. Dear listeners, that was the 12th episode of our series, Health Tourism. Until our next program, goodbye and God bless.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sesvi. He's a professor of information.
the spotlight.
Hello, welcome to the Spotlight. I'm Kaveh Tahlai. Iran has said that its military drills send a message that Iran is ready to confront any threat against the Islamic Republic. Why would Iran conduct military drills on such a vast scale? In this edition of the Spotlight, we will look at the message that these drills send, especially to Iran's adversaries like Israel.
Meet Joshan, an Iranian missile system that hunts down any hostile target flying in low altitudes. This and a range of other homegrown military hardware were deployed to this air defense maneuver, dubbed Defenders of Velayat Skies. Held in Iran's sprawling central desert, the drills were staged jointly by the Iranian Army's Air Defense and the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps Aerospace Division to bolster the country's defensive capabilities.
This drill, we've launched an integrated air defense network which brings together all of the capacities of the Army and the IRGC's air defense units. The two military forces need to work in coordination with each other to ensure the security of Iran's skies.
The joint drills send a message that Iran's armed forces join hands and stand strongly to confront any threat against our land and our ideals.
The two-day maneuver simulated real-life combat scenarios where Iran's sensitive facilities are the target and must be protected using indigenous air defense systems. The Army's Majid and the IRGC's Desfoud were among the new generation of missile systems that were unveiled and successfully test-fired in the drills. The domestically built systems were assigned to intercept inbound cruise missiles targeting Iran's nuclear sites. Officials say the maneuver has been a success, and this means Iranian homegrown weapons can defend the country's skies.
Today, we're capable of ensuring the security of our borders using military hardware that are designed and produced by our experts. Today, we do not rely on foreign weapons, and our cutting-edge equipment meet all of our defensive needs.
The armed forces also tested their electronic defense capabilities using their latest radar systems, including this newly developed GOATS radar. Built by the IRGC's Air Defense Force, GOATS is a pulse Doppler radar that can track and determine the location and speed of any target flying within a range of 500 kilometers and an altitude of 90,000 feet. Military officials say the country's self-sufficiency is thanks to decades of U.S.-imposed arms embargoes that led Iran to a point where it no longer needs to import defense equipment. Phase of the maneuvers, and the Iranian air defense says all of the set goals have so far been achieved successfully. Officials say one of the major goals was to show that Iran's security is not tied to foreign arms, and the country's skies are safer with homegrown weapons. Yusuf Jalali from the location of the drills.
Let me introduce our guest for this edition of the Spotlight. We have Seyed Mohsen Abbas. He's a journalist and political analyst joining us from London. Also joining us is John Busnish, journalist and political analyst, who joins us from Belgrade.
This is the Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Okay, I'd like to welcome you both. Let me first start with you, if I may, John Busnich. You're looking at these military drills that are rather vast in scale and scope. Some of the details, these involve air defense units, domestically developed military hardware, and there were joint aerial maneuvers, another important highlight, that was attended by Iranian air defense divisions of the Army and the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, the IRGC. Why do you think Iran is holding these military drills in this scope at this point in time?
Well, obviously, Iran is under serious pressure and threat of violent attack by not just the United States, but by the American ally in the region, Israel. There's also threat of involvement with Saudi Arabia. So this is a natural response on the part of the Iranian armed forces to protect their sovereign domestic territory. And it's obvious from your drills that these are domestic defense drills. It looks far different from an aggressive military practice. I see nothing wrong with this. This is the same type of maneuver that has been practiced in countries all around the world in every region. Nothing wrong with it, and no reason not to continue it. And the important thing that I've noted with your development in Iran is that your systems are homegrown, self-made systems, which makes you impenetrable to arms sanctions, which is one of the first methods that the United States uses to bring a target country to its knees. So I see nothing wrong with this. This is strictly in accordance with international law, and it's a natural element of the sovereignty of Iran.
Sebastian Abbas, war games or military maneuvers are most noted not just for the equipment, but the messages that it sends. So looking at one aspect of this, which is what our guest there pointed out, John Busnich, talked about the indigenous capabilities. And we're looking at air defense missile systems, radars, reconnaissance equipment, electronic warfare devices, communication systems, visual surveillance network, just to name a few, again, all indigenously made. What message does that send?
Well, it sends a message that Iran is totally unreliant on external forces for its self-defense. That is thanks to the American embargoes, ironically enough. It's the sanctions that the Americans have placed persistently over four decades, which have, in a way, made it absolutely no-brainer for the Iranians to develop their own. But I think it's not to be underestimated just how brilliant the development of those indigenous weapons has been as an achievement for Iran, a nation which wasn't able to get its hands on information or even industrial parts, etc. For them to have achieved this self-sufficiency is incredible. In fact, it's got to the point where Iran is now ranked openly as the 14th most powerful military nation in the world, certainly, and it's also ranked in the upper echelons in terms of design technology. So, for instance, with certain mobile missile systems, they're even ranked number two. So this is an incredible sort of achievement by any stretch of the imagination in terms of the weapons that Iran can now use. And it's the main and sole reason, I think, that the Israel and the Anglo-Zionist imperialist forces haven't attacked Iran. They really would like to as a matter of urgency, but they dare not because they know that this is not dealing with a nation that will not be able to defend itself. They know it's perfectly capable of defending itself. And it's, of course, one of those populous countries in the Middle East, and it boasts now, as I argue, if in the Middle East, the largest armed forces in the region with over 1 million active reserve personnel as well. So that's significantly eclipsing all other regional militaries except for those of Turkey and Egypt in the region.
John Busnich, the IRGC commander, he has said a very important statement here. Again, we need to make sure that we cover this, which is why I have to ask you what you think. And he has said that the invariable message of unity between the IRGC and the Army in their duty to serve the country's defense. He said it was rooted in the dual forces' defensive cooperation during the Western-backed imposed war that former Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein waged on the Islamic Republic from 1980 to 1988. This dual cooperation of the IRGC and the army is important, but when he went into the context of during the time that Iraq attacked Iran, does that show, as you mentioned in the beginning, that Iran is getting prepared because it feels that there are scenarios that it may be attacked?
Well, I think that the saber rattling from Washington, both during the Trump era and now during the Biden era, is the same. And unfortunately for Iran, the Israel lobby inside America has a great influence on American foreign policy. Not only do they cooperate on arms development and regional military, let's say, coordination, the Israel lobby in the United States actually pays for the election of many members of Congress who therefore push a military agenda against Iran. So you're not dealing just with the United States' general imperial attitude towards countries around the world. You're dealing with a focused initiative from Israel in your own region. And given these circumstances and given the history of the American use of puppet regimes, as they did in the case of Iraq, to attack you from the side, I think that there's no doubt whatsoever that Iran is pursuing the rational, logical, and strictly legal approach of defending its own sovereignty. And I want to underline here that there are many people in the world that don't realize that the United States of America has invaded more countries than Nazi Germany invaded. This is not a joke. When you've got the President of the United States first initiating economic war on your country, which has gone on for years in the form of economic sanctions, then embargoes on a routine, normal supplies that have nothing to do with weaponry, and the coordination of battle plans with regional powers around you, and especially with Israel, you have absolutely no choice but to prepare to defend yourself. To do anything else would be suicidal.
Okay, so let's look, say, Mohsen Abbas, at through your eyes, what Israel is thinking first. Israel has made numerous threats against Iran militarily, and yet you have these types of exercises taking place. This particular one that has spanned now for 2 days, very significant. I'm looking again. I won't tell you how many sheets of paper I have that talk about the different options that Iran has, the different military capabilities, like the Quds radar capable of locating targets at a range of over 500 kilometers and at an altitude of over 90,000 feet. So when Israel views this, what is it thinking?
Well, Israel is thinking its days are numbered. The truth is that Israel's entire, if you like, menace was this sense that you couldn't penetrate their Iron Dome, that their army was invincible, that they were capable of striking anywhere, anytime, any place, and they used to. They did it with the Iraqi nuclear facilities once upon a time. They hit all sorts of places in Syria. There was the time when they would do that very comfortably. They're still doing such things where they know there's no comeback. But you see, Iran is not Syria, and Iran is not Egypt or any of these other nations, be they puppet or minor opposition to Israel. Iran is a fully capable military power with an ideology and an absolute powerful core leadership, which has a real commitment to moral politics, towards justice, and towards really fighting for the oppressed in that region. That's something that Imam Khomeini left as a legacy, and it is continued by the Rehbe Mukawama with the leader of Iran, maintaining that sense that Iran doesn't just have a responsibility internally to defend itself, but it also has a moral obligation to protect and to help those oppressed people in the Middle East, who for decades and decades have been violated, their sovereignty, their rights, their humanity, their lives, the political prisoners, left, right, and center, all being captured by the proxies of Israel, like Saudi Arabia, etc. I call them openly Zionist proxies. United Arab Emirates have declared it openly. The Bahrainis have declared it openly now as well. The Saudis are just not fully coming out with it. But you see, Iran stands tall within all this, with this, its military capability. It was the mistake that Gaddafi arguably made as well, because he dropped his guard, didn't build up his military effectively, and you saw what NATO and the Americans did to Gaddafi not so long ago. You saw that also within the Saddam regime, in fact, it was his weaknesses militarily, which they also exploited. This is what the Anglo-Zionist Empire does, whether it's its own lackeys or whether it's opposition. It looks at the military power and judges whether it should attack based on that. Iran has the Zulfqar short-range ballistic missiles. It has the Qiyam-1, longer distance, sort of 466-mile range missiles. The Fateh 313, which actually knocked out the American base after the assassination and murder, the extrajudicial killing of Lieutenant General Soleimani, was another example of just how powerful Iranian ballistic missiles have become. And this is what Israel is looking at. Now, Israel is nonetheless trying to do things to cause problems. Firstly, in the last month and a half, we've seen it visibly come in the open front line in the north of Iran, on the borders where Azerbaijani territory exists. They openly started trying to get their own corporations there stationed in Nagorno-Karabakh and the borders of Iran. Iran has given them an answer with an exercise there as well. That was one example. The other, of course, is that in northern Iraq, there's another border which the Kurds tend to have, the Kurds of Iraq have with Iran. And again there, we've noted that terrorist groups, Kurdish terrorist groups, have tried to make incursions. And these terrorist groups are backed and financed by the likes of Israel and America and the Western powers in order to see if there's a vulnerability and weakness in the northern defense of Iran. Iran's exercises there, I think Fateh Khaybar exercise was another indication that Iran is not going to take any nonsense with these maneuvers that Israel is initiating. Of course, Iraq is still very much infiltrated by Israel and America, occupied by America, essentially. So that side of the Iranian border is also not 100% secure. And we've seen, of course, with the fall of Afghanistan, yet another front potentially opening up for Iran with the return of what I call the neo-Taliban. There's no real guarantee as to which way the neo-Taliban will ultimately fall, depending on their sort of economic circumstances and also the attitude of Pakistan, which is very, very critical. Perhaps I'll go into that in your next question. But the eastern border of Iran and the western border of Iran are equally, if like, in need of massive attention. And this is what Iran is showing with these maneuvers.
So I don't get it, John Bosnich. You have Israel that has threatened Iran militarily, has attacked Syria, has attacked Iran's nuclear facilities. You have Iran that has said the U.S. has relocated, based on information that Turkey gave, Daesh terrorists into Afghanistan, so there's instability perhaps that's going to come from there. You also have the situation, as our guest there mentioned, in Erbil regarding the Turkish terrorists there in the form of PJAC. And, of course, the U.S. military threats that have come here and there. And yet Iran is made out to be the bad guy by the U.S. How is that?
Well, I mean, that's standard demonization. If you plan to take a military act against another country, first you have to demonize them in the eyes of the world. So you tell any number of lies, you make any number of claims that are necessary to restrict international support for the rule of law. Because, unfortunately, the way propaganda works is that if you can make the target country appear to be so evil that there is no, that they don't even have a right to international law, then you have a free hand to bomb them, to invade them, to overturn their regime, to run a color revolution, to do any of the panoply of illegal acts that are now the standard course in the American empire. So Iran has to not only defend itself, not only have its own independent weapon systems, not only practice those weapon systems, but it also has to pose a serious response threat within the region. Because if the American forces and their allies locate just outside of Iran's borders, Iran has to have local regional safety. So I think that the next step now for Iran, now that it has demonstrated a military capacity to defend itself, is to work solidly to strengthen your ties with especially Russia and China. If Iran can arrange even limited military exercises in cooperation with Russia and China, I believe you'll have the security that you need to protect your country. These are important aspects, and of course there will be efforts by America and by Israel to infiltrate agents and disruptors inside Iran, but I trust that Iran's domestic security services have got that under control. Now you need to look to the world, you need to look to the UN, you need to look to the World Court, and you need to tighten as much as you can your cooperation with the two superpowers which are not going to allow you to be attacked, and that's Russia and China.
Sure, but it was very interesting, Sayyid Mohsen Abbas, when the U.S., very tired saying the use of other options or all the options on the table type approach here. The interesting part being that you have the U.S. Secretary of State making that statement in the presence of the Israeli Prime Minister and also the Emirati Foreign Minister. And I'm going to quote what Israel has said. If the Iranians don't believe the world is serious about stopping them, they will race to the bomb. Israel reserves the right to act at any given moment in any given way. The part that is interesting is that the UAE is not too far away from Iran. So if a war does break out, the UAE in one way or another might be geographically in that war somehow. So I'm curious what the UAE foreign minister thinks when Israel makes and levels that type of threats against Iran when it has formalized its so-called relationship with Israel.
Well, the UAE has unfortunately made a heinous decision for its own people. They've literally opened the doors to Israel to come in and take over the UAE, and it's pretty much happening right before our very eyes. And of course, part of that doing the deal with Israel has also meant that they're actually allowing them to become a military threat to Iran, not so far away. So yes, it's already been said very clearly that the UAE is very much going to be on the front line. If anything happens to Iran, it's very much within the sights of the Iranian military. Now, the reality is that the Americans are there in Bahrain with their Fifth Fleet, and
right.
They've got all sorts of other aspects. But the fact of the matter is that UAE is, along with its neighbors, very much antagonistic. And we've got these two wings building up now, the Eurasian bloc and the Anglo-Zionist or Anglo-American bloc, which is building up. And Iran is very critical within all of that scenario.
I got to unfortunately jump in and say, Mohsen Abbas, I'm sorry, just to give 30 seconds to John Busnish because we're fresh out of time. John Busnish, Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi, his slogan, to build relations with the neighbors. Iran and Saudi Arabia are almost at the brink, according to some outlets, not confirmed, they might even open up their embassies. And yet the U.S. rhetoric is turned up against Iran, just with what happened tonight and recent statements. It doesn't go together. Do you think it's because of that that the U.S. is reacting this way?
That's certainly a factor. Any advance in Iranian diplomacy in the interests of maintaining regional peace is diametrically opposed to the American and Israeli war plans.
Okay.
So by simultaneously defending yourself and opening your doors to friendly relations is your safest option.
Thank you for that, John Busnish, journalist and political analyst. And thank you, Sayyid Mohsen Abbas. Sorry to have jumped in there. Journalist and political analyst from London.
Sure.
And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. Thanks for tuning in. Until next time.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to English service of the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz, every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat, or BAT 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box 19395-6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
This is Back to Reality.
It's the show where we discuss the most topical of topics, the most controversial of controversies, and the most important affairs of affairs.
Roundtable from Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Dear listeners, thank you so very much for joining us on today's brand new episode of Back to Reality. I am your humble, hopefully favorite host, Zainab, and in the studio with me, I have two brothers in faith and humanity. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullah. It's an honor to be here. Thank you very much.
Thank you, you guys. Would you do a brief introduction?
I'm Muzaffar Haider.
I'm Hassanain.
From the UK.
From India.
So today, first of all, thank you so much, you guys. Yeah. Let's talk about something that we deal with now on a daily, if not a secondly, is that a word? A momentarily, like every second sort of basis.
Oh, yeah, we do, yeah.
And it's become such an integral part of our lives, and often I feel that most of us can't even function without it. Social media, WhatsApp, Telegram, Instagram, oh, that's all the social medias I have. Other people would have Facebook, I don't
Snapchat.
Know, Snapchat, TikTok, and stuff like that. Brother Mulafa, on a scale of 1 through 10, how active would you consider yourself on these platforms?
I'm not that active anymore. Yeah, I used to be really active.
When?
About a year, 2 years ago.
What happened?
I got blocked from Twitter. I got blocked from Facebook. So then I was just like, yeah, forget it. I'm not going to create another account to try and go back.
What about WhatsApp, Telegram?
WhatsApp and Telegram, I can't say I'm really active. I'd say I use it as a tool because I need to communicate with family and friends.
Exactly.
And stuff. But no, not really. No. Every new feature that they come up with, like the on WhatsApp, they have this thing where you can post like a memory. What's it called?
A story,
yeah. I just like, oh, come on, I'm not doing that. You know, so no, I wouldn't say I'm really attached.
Mm.
I was really attached, though, like crazy attached to, because it's the numbers, isn't it? especially on social media like Instagram and Facebook,
and
Twitter, you're seeing all the likes that you're getting. You're all seeing all these ticks, and you're like, ooh, my followers are growing, and it really is a buzz.
Yeah, it's like a competition.
It's actually like a dopamine hit.
Dopamine effect.
They say that it's a really, really bad form of addiction that is just totally justified in today's society.
I totally agree with you, Brother Hussein.